Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and thank you for joining me today. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and thank you for joining me for another opportunity to have an in-depth conversation about a topic that really is relevant for all of us. So I am thrilled that you are here with me today. We're going to be exploring how the microbiome is revolutionizing the pursuit of a healthy life. And my guest today is Dr. Rodney Dietert, and he is such a profound and inspiring person, and I'm just thrilled he made time to be here with us for this conversation. Let me just say a little bit about Dr. Dietert. He is professor of immunotoxicology at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He received his PhD in immunogenetics from the University of Texas at Austin. Among the authored and edited academic books are Strategies for Protecting Your Child's Immune System and Immune Toxicity, Immune Dysfunction, and Chronic Disease. Rodney previously directed Cornell's graduate field of immunology, the Program on Breast Cancer Environmental Risk Factors, and the Institute for Comparative Environmental Toxicology. And he has served as a senior fellow in the Cornell Center for the Environment. Recently, he appeared in the 2014 award-winning documentary Microbirth. He is the author of The Human Superorganism, How the Microbiome is Revolutionizing the Pursuit of a Healthy Life. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Rodney to the show today. So, Rodney, thank you for joining us and welcome.
Well, thank you. It's such a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, it's a delight to have you because, as we were just sharing a little bit before we got onto the show, I think this topic of understanding the relevance of the microbiome to our health, to our life, to our future generations is becoming one of the most important conversations that is going on right now in the health field. And I know this is an area that you're passionate about. So we're going to take the opportunity in our conversation today to really explore what we're talking about when we say the microbiome, the implications of the microbiome to our health, and how to help restore our healthy gut flora in this environment that's so critical for our health. So let's just jump right in here, and let's first of all define this thing called the microbiome.
Right. So the microbiome are the microorganisms that live on and within us, and that includes bacteria. It includes a category called archaea that used to be a part of bacteria, but now they have their own category, viruses and fungi and parasites, and all of those together, again, that are on our skin, in our gut, in our nose, our airways, our mouth, our urogenital tract, are what we call the microbiome. And there are thousands of species, and each well-suited to their particular location on or in our body. And what's interesting is if you think about it, they're actually sitting at the borders that separate us from the external environment of our body. So if they're on our skin, again, they're between the skin and the outside world. They're on the outside part of our gut, and they're at our mouth. So they're the first thing that when we eat food or we take medicine or a supplement, they see it first. And they're in our nose and our airways. And so the air we breathe is first seen by the microbes. And as a sense, they are really our gatekeeper, our filter. And the mammalian part of us as humans is really dependent upon what they do with environmental chemicals, with food and food additives, and with drugs in terms of the effects on the internal part of us. So our safety, the efficacy of drugs, and the actual individual risk for environmental toxicants is in many ways largely determined by the microbiome.
So when we talk about the microbiome, we're talking about this collective universe, really, of organisms that inhabits us. They're on us, within us. Part of how we evolved, correct? This is part.
Exactly. We're more. It's useful to think of us, really, instead of how I was taught about human biology, and even what I used to teach in the 70s when I came to Cornell. we're, instead of that kind of concept of biology, we are really something like a walking around coral reef or a mobile tropical rainforest on two legs, because we are carrying a composite of some of the of many organisms and species that live in the most remote part of Earth that are also within our gut or on our skin or the like. And we're going around with those. And it turns out we're not just being generous souls who help transport these things that we can't see with the naked eye around. We are actually reliant upon them for us to be complete and healthy organisms, healthy humans.
So for many years, we have been taught, like the prevailing paradigm, I would say, is to see us at war with these organisms, right? I mean, we've done a lot to really attack and attempt to destroy and eliminate these really critical microorganisms necessary for our survival, necessary for our health. And we're now having to rethink our relationship with these microorganisms and repair the damage that we have done for ourselves and, as I said earlier, for future generations as well.
Absolutely. I mean, the prevailing theory in the 20th century, or the goal, you might say, was to purify us. We wanted to purify us of all of what we call germs or the microorganisms, and in some ways for good reasons. So this is an unintended consequence of a battle fought against the microbes, but and we won it. In that regard, we were able to control typhus and cholera and some of the things that were huge threats in the early part of the 20th century. But the problem is we lost the war because we've now replaced the main killers in the world of infectious diseases with what are called, used to be called chronic diseases, are now called non-communicable diseases. And these are the things like Alzheimer's, dementia, obesity, heart disease, cancer, asthma, all the autoimmune conditions that claim now it's up to 75% by the CDC estimate last February of global deaths, not just in the U.S. and developed countries, but developing nations. And beyond that, they're the kind of diseases that we don't really cure very often. You usually have to be under medical care with them, like diabetes or heart disease or hypertension, and you may be taking drugs for decades, if not the rest of your life. And we tend to accumulate them, too. So if you have one, even as a child being diagnosed with obesity or type 1 diabetes or asthma in childhood, the risk of that group of children is increased to develop 8 to 10 more of those non-communicable diseases with aging. So as we go through life, if we do nothing different than we're doing right now, the prospect is you will become more disabled, more needed for medicines and care, medical care, that we don't have enough of to go around on this path, and leading part of your life in a way that is really isolating in a sense. I'll give an example, if you don't mind. I just came back, and I do this in my talks. I actually do a slide presentation on selecting your seat on the airplane, and which most of us have done. If you travel and fly, you pick a seat. Well, I was on a plane that happened to have someone peanut allergic, so that the passengers just yesterday coming home, and the passengers were instructed they were not to bring out products, food products with peanuts, and there would be none served on the airplane. And the reason is, of course, is that peanut-induced allergy can be so severe that it's life-threatening with anaphylaxis. And you can have the same problems with perfume and fragrance sensitivities, with pet-related allergy or dog allergy, and think of someone with MS and a service dog sitting in the row in front of a asthmatic child who has a dog allergy. We're almost unable in this day and time to all congregate on an airplane, at a child's birthday party, at a church dinner or a science conference meal. We have so many accommodations we have to make, and they just weren't there in the 70s because those kind of diseases like that simply weren't there like they are today. And that's the trade-off we've made. We won a battle against infectious diseases, and we're now dying and living with an epidemic of a whole group of these non-communicable diseases that have all been going up in prevalence dramatically since about 1970.
So can you connect the dots between the destruction of our microbiome through whether it's antibiotics or environmental, you know, antibiotics that have been in cleaning products, and there are other things that actually impact our microbiome and destroy it, and this growth of these non-communicable diseases that you've been talking about?
Right. So there are a lot of there are a lot of pieces that go into constructing the dots, because many of the human studies are really by association, and that doesn't, by themselves, they don't mean that destruction of the microbiome or a change in the microbiome causes a disease, but it is the other pieces that fit in that show us that, in fact, that's what happens in many, if not all, of these cases. What occurs is that the baby is really born minus the microbes, or if the baby's born minus the microbes, that's really an incomplete human. That is not what a healthy human is going to look like. And part of the reason is that the baby needs the microbes both to produce vitamins, they make certain vitamins for us, but also to really help the physiological systems like the immune system be trained. I mentioned they're sitting at our barriers. So they're on the skin barrier, they're on the gut barrier, and they're to the outside world, exposure to the outside world. And things like immune cells, 60 to 70% of our immune cells are in the gut. They're sitting on the other side of the barrier, and they're being instructed in what is a real threat to our health and what is safe. And the bottom line is, simplistically, for the immune system anyway, if the microbes aren't there, the immune system will eventually self-destruct in most cases, because it's going to be reacting to things like peanut allergens that are not a threat, but, you know, it wasn't trained that those are okay, or to pollen, pollens and those proteins of various kinds, or pet-related allergens, or your own thyroid and autoimmune thyroiditis. And that's exactly what we see. That's what happens. So the risk of what is said to be inflammatory-driven disease, and that's what many of these non-communicable diseases are, is they require unresolved or improper inflammation to go on in our body. The risk of that is dramatically increased if the immune system matures in the absence of a robust and diversified group of microbes. And that's why it becomes very important to have those there. And we now know that it's not just the immune system, but the neurological system and the brain and its development and subsequent neurobehavior and moods and food cravings are dramatically controlled by the chemicals that are made by microbes in the gut. And there are also other contributions from other sites of microbes as well. So we're now learning there's this whole area called psychobiotics, where it's turning out, if you want to address something like major depressive disorder, very likely you're going to be able to use a bacterial species or their chemical metabolites and use those to help shift the problem rather than a heavy-duty medication that may have many, many side effects, because they can communicate and alter neurodevelopment and neurofunction from the gut, and they do this through things like the vagus nerve and a couple of other routes they can influence the brain. And that's really the way it's been done for millennia, in a sense. When we eat foods that support particular bacteria and particular microbes, we eat those, they're healthy, they grow a garden that is useful for our mood, our neurodevelopment, and our behavior. But in the absence of that, we have problems. And so right now, for example, one of the really interesting, some of the studies are that investigators in this area can take rats and mice, and they can change a bacterial species in the gut, or they can actually just put in the metabolites, the chemicals that species would make. And they can change animals from being very social and playing around and enjoying the cage mates that they have with them, to being OCD and obsessing on a ball and being totally oblivious that there are other animals in the cage at all. And then they can flip the switch and turn them back. And that's an example of how powerful the influence of the microbes are on our neurological behavior. And it turns out that the gut makes more neurotransmitters than the brain, and many of those, serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, are produced by the microbes directly in the gut. And those that are produced by our gut mammalian cells, like enterocytes, can be regulated also by the gut microbes. So they both directly produce neurotransmitters, and the spectrum of those, different species produce different ones. So your ratio of those, or the relative amounts of those, can really affect your mood. And by changing those, you have a chance to modulate it. This is essentially the majority of our genes that's sitting on these thousands of species in each human, across humans, that are affecting our metabolism and what happens in our body. And the good news is they're actually easier to change than the chromosomal genes. So the latest estimates are, by comparison, that the mammalian chromosome in humans from the Human Genome Project results is somewhere around 22 to 25,000 genes. But among the microbes across all humans, they're estimated to be just under 10 million genes. And they're making enzymes that digest chemicals and food and that signal our mammalian cells and that do a whole variety of things affecting our physiological systems. So this is essentially a good news story now that we know it, in that we've really got something we can do that can be effective and useful in self-care and in working with health professionals to change the ball game on these diseases that are claiming most of our lives.
It makes you really redefine our concept of who we are. You know, we think we're making choices and behaving and thinking out of our own free will. And little do we know, our little microbiome community is directly, you know, pulling the strings in lots of ways about
exactly.
How
there's a wonderful paper by a group at University College Cork, Ireland, John Cryan and his colleagues, called Geppetto the Puppet Master, where he goes through and lays out the arguments for the impact they have on our mood, our behavior, our food cravings. And so the idea is, if that's really the garden you've grown down in your gut and on your skin and in your airways, then it's about time for you to become a master gardener of your own body.
Wow. You know, you just said so much in the last few minutes. I want to go back to birth, because I want to start there, because I don't know how many people are aware of the fact that a baby does not have an active immune system. It really requires being inoculated by the mother's microorganisms as the baby descends through the vaginal tract, because, as you said, the urogenital tract all has these communities living in it, and they enter the baby as through the mouth, through the nose, through the skin, as it moves through the birth canal. Which is the good news, if the mother, first of all, is healthy, right? If she has a healthy community. And number two, this growing tendency to have cesarean births, which are on the rise, by the way, the incidence of choosing, sometimes it's a choice, sometimes it's a necessity, a cesarean birth. But there are some big problems when a child is born in a cesarean manner. And you talk about some of the things that parents and doctors need to know to help that child have that communication. And I want you to talk a little bit about that. But I think in one of your slides that I looked at when I was doing the research about this topic that you're talking about, you gave some really startling statistics of what kinds of microorganisms a cesarean child is seeded with compared to a child born from a vaginal birth. So do you want to just elaborate on all that for a little bit?
Sure. And this actually goes back to a change in our understanding of even fundamental immunology. So I guess you'd say rather humbling way, about half probably of what I learned in terms of immunology in the 70s as a PhD student and then subsequently taught when I first came to Cornell, about half of that's probably now viewed as wrong. And it's simply that we have a better and different understanding. So we were taught, you know, that the human baby is good to go when the baby's born, that all the immune cells are there and everything's ready and it's just wonderful. But the problem is that we now know there are additional populations of immune cells and very specialized ones that are sitting around these barriers, like the gut and the skin and the airways. And we weren't able to detect those back in the 70s. And it turns out it's not just whether they're there. It's the, you know, whether you have two times as many of one type of cell that's that regulates things versus another, or whether the ratio shifted the other direction, really determines how your body's going to react and really determines what happens with different kinds of inflammation and responses that may go on in your tissues. And again, the majority of the immune cells are out there in the tissues, so that is actually becoming more interesting than simply looking at what we used to do was the thymus and the spleen and the bone marrow. That was your immune system. But actually, it's pretty much everywhere else that I find is the most interesting sites of activity and action. So we now know that the baby probably gets exposed to some microbes. Actually, through the placenta, there are some microbes in the placenta, but they don't seem to do too much in seeding the baby. So the environment's not really completely sterile, but it's more just to help the immune system during pregnancy to mature a bit. But the big seeding event is at birth, and that happens in a couple different ways. The first and the most important is vaginal delivery, or natural childbirth, and that's where the baby coming down the birth canal gets exposed to the mom's microbes, and particularly the gut GI tract microbiome and vaginal microbiome. And that is the primary seeding event that's actually going to install the microbes in the baby's gut microbiome in the gut. And then subsequent to that is also skin-skin contact. And that is important. That really helps. But all of those body sites are getting essentially populated with microbes right there at birth. That is an incredible event, and we really didn't understand all that was going on with birth. So we've unintentionally disrupted that. We've interfered in a way that presents problems with the baby actually becoming complete, and that was one of the ideas that actually got me into the microbiome. It was the middle of the night waking up from a dream idea that the single most important thing you could ever measure in a baby that would predict a life filled with health from one filled with disease for that baby is the extent to which a baby self-completes with a robust, diversified microbiome. And that understanding that really, really tells you what, you know, other things happen during life, of course, but really tells you the extent to which the baby is a whole healthy organism.
So I just recently learned through a friend's daughter who was getting who was birthing and had to have a cesarean that they now are doing this process called seeding with the baby. Can you just explain that a little bit? And which I think is profound, especially for babies born in an emergency room setting where they're breathing in all these microbes in the emergency room, not through the vaginal tract, and then just not getting seated properly because of how they were brought into the world. But there is a solution now for those children.
There are, and there'll probably be other options down the road now that we know what the problem is. So, first of all, sometimes cesarean is medically necessary, and definitely it should be done when it's medically necessary. But as you mentioned, elective cesarean has been increasing significantly, and particularly in particular countries and particular locations. And it simply prevents the baby from being seeded with mom's microbiome. And what has been done, and this is from the research and the peer-reviewed publications of Dr. Gloria Dominguez-Bello at NYU Medical School, and she and her colleagues have used a vaginal swabbing technique. So they actually collect and then keep sterilely the microbes that are in the vaginal tract just before cesarean and hopefully also before antibiotic exposure, because cesarean is a surgical procedure, and pretty much every major surgical procedure you go through, you're going to have antibiotics administered. So they collect that, they hold it, and then at birth with cesarean delivery, they will swab the baby, including in the mouth. And what they've been able to show is that while it's not 100% identical with what happens with vaginal delivery, it is very close. And the profile of the gut microbes looks like the mom's microbiome in large part. And that's really important because eventually the baby will acquire microbes. But as you stated, what will happen is they're going to come from the local environment. And if the baby is hospital delivered, that'll be the hospital attendants and the environment of the hospital. And those are not the microbes that you would want to pick for your baby.
And, you know, I've encountered so many infants who've developed eczema after they were born cesarean.
Yes.
And, you know, they just have all these health problems from the very beginning because of the lack of the taking in and growing the right microorganisms in their intestinal tract.
Exactly. And so when you see that, eczema or atopic dermatitis, and that's one of the often early age allergic manifestations, and when you see that, that is really showing you that the immune system is not maturing correctly, and you've already got dysfunction in place. It's reacting to things it shouldn't be reacting to, and there, unfortunately, as now physicians treat presenting symptoms, they haven't really known about some of these comorbid conditions that will arise later, and so they're not protecting the baby against those. So it's sort of a march of non-communicable diseases, and it'll usually start with something like that. It could be eczema, it could be allergic rhinitis or hay fever or asthma or, type 1 diabetes, again, childhood onset, or obesity in children.
Mm. So we're seeding our whole intestinal tract. I mean, it's really the whole body.
You are seeding the whole body. When the baby comes out, the baby's in the world and the microbes are there, and it's a matter of, are they going to be donated by the family, or is the baby going to get them elsewhere?
Right. So then as we develop a healthy immune system by developing this microbiome community, what are some of the vitamins that are actually created through these microbiome communities in our gut?
Well, they make vitamin K, and there, of course, you can have external sources. Strategies are to supplement so that you try to provide what the microbes would be providing. But what people didn't realize in constructing formula is that it is missing some pretty major pieces. It's missing, and that's a whole other story, is why breast milk is so vital whenever breastfeeding is possible, what it really does for the whole baby, including the microbes. And it turns out that the microbes need food. So they need food, and the food is very specific for the particular species of bacteria, among bacteria or for other microbes. And they also know how to affect your brain so that you will to call for it as well, or to affect your food choices or affect your food cravings. And we now know, for example, that one of the miracles of breast milk, one of the things that bothered people for a long time, is it has a large component of sugars, complex carbohydrates, not the sugar like we think of that promotes yeast overgrowth and other things, but complex carbohydrates that are undigestible by our mammalian human cells. And they're not there for the mammalian part of us. They never were. But honed over thousands of years, millennia, breast milk is a food source that is as much for our microbes as any other part of us. And so when people say, is the microbiome work and focus on that a fad? I usually say, only if you can convince me that the refining of breast milk over our ancestral history and the fact that there's so much of breast milk that's for the microbes and not for the rest of us is just a happenstance of nature, and nature's wasting that. No, it's not a fad. They were always intended to be with us, and we need them if we're going to be healthy.
So you need to have either the vaginal birth or to have the swabbing of these microorganisms from the vaginal cavity and wherever they take it from for the baby. And
then you have to
complete the natural process with breastfeeding, because it's that unique formula that the body makes of all those sugars that brings those microbiome to life and supports them and nourishes them, because without the right food, they're not going to grow. You're not going to get a
healthy exactly right.
Microbiome.
The mom's donating through breast milk. The mom's donating, first of all, some immune components that the baby really needs. And
like colostrum.
Those are really important. And then there are additional microbes that actually are transmitted in the breast milk. So they help some additional seeding. They're helping the microbes mature in the gut, and they are also providing some additional microbes that will come in at that age, you know, in the zero to in the birth to 1 year, for example. And so you're getting additional microbes there. And formula doesn't have these components in there, you know. It's not to say it could never have it in the future, but people have not known it needed to be there, and they've certainly not got strategies to put all of those components there. So it has those two things plus the food for the microbes. And that is absolutely essential. And the microbes change. They are maturing between, you know, if you look at the window from birth to 2 years of age in particular, that is so vital for many of our physiological systems. And the microbes are maturing across the barrier right along with our immune system, with the child's brain, with the GI tract and the airways, and are helping that maturity. And there's communication signals back from our immune cells to the microbes. There are things going on in that direction, and they are helping as the microbes progress and change. And then you start to get more of an adult profile of the microbiome a little bit later in childhood. And so they grow up together, and they need to. And that's sort of what, if we look back, we learned that lesson actually in a different way. You may remember in the 90s, there were studies over in Europe and in several different countries, and I call them the German barnyard study, but it was the study that if moms are not already genetically allergic, or we say atopic, and they're growing up on a farm with farm animals around, and also, I should say, without using a lot of pesticides on the farm, because that will nullify this effect. Mm-hmm. But if they're growing up, if the pregnancy is there with the farm animals and the children are born there and growing up with the farm animals, they don't have the incidence of asthma and allergies that children would have a couple miles down the road in an urban setting and are, mm-hmm. who are not being exposed to the barnyard. Mm-hmm. And that's been seen in many, many different countries. It used to be called the hygiene hypothesis. But what it's showing us is that the exposure to the microbes and the exposure to things in the environment, like animals with animal allergens potentially, that co-exposure early in life for the baby and the child is really important, because it actually is protective against non-communicable diseases.
So fascinating. I think we should talk more about some of the implications of an altered microbiome in regards to food cravings. I know that's a big area of research, and you talked about the impact on our neurotransmitters. So let's talk a little bit about that, and also let's include some of the strategies that people need to be aware of so they can start healing their little environment, their rainforest in their gut, as I like to call it.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, I should say that I describe my own personal experience, and I just mention this as an introduction, because I had gone through most of my adult life, more than 30 years, with an undiagnosed, up until recently, non-communicable disease. It was gastroesophageal reflux disease, or it's known as GERD. And it turned out that it was striking during the night, or very active during the night, and was contributing, along with some allergies, to recurrent sinusitis or sinus infections that would get so bad I would have to have antibiotics. And this was happening 3 to 4 times a year. So I was getting 3 to 4 rounds of antibiotics over more than 30 years of my life. And so you can estimate about 100 rounds of antibiotics, approximately. And the GERD was finally diagnosed, but even that didn't provide a ready solution to the issue. And it turned out by accident I'd organized a meeting over in Frankfurt, Germany, or co-organized this, and it was a residential meeting. So we were living near this institute. We were eating local Frankfurt-produced food, and there was a chef that was preparing all the meals. And we're actually working in a sedentary way. So we're spending like 12 hours a day around tables and in different groups and trying to produce a scientific monograph and not getting a lot of exercise. And even with that, I wound up by the fifth day with my clothes not fitting. I had dropped a pant size. And it turned out it was because it was reduced inflammation. I had abdominal inflammation that had receded because I was no longer consuming some, apparently, some foods that I had been eating back in the U.S. that were really causing constant, ongoing, improper inflammation in my gut. And that was a revelation to me, but it was telling me, you know, there's some foods that are going to be not too healthy for me, and I need to figure out what they are. But in addition, the other piece of the puzzle was to work on the microbiome, and a microbiome that would be compatible with a different diet. And so what happened was I got back, and my doctor said, wow, what, you know, I started losing weight, and for 2.5 years now I have not needed any antibiotics. And my physicians are saying, what did you do? Because we tell people to lose weight, and they usually struggle to do it. And how did you do this? And the answer was, I changed both my diet and the microbiome so they were in sync, so that the microbiome was in sync and craving and supporting a healthy diet. And that's really one of the messages in the book, is we need to eat a healthy diet, but in addition, we need to help our garden that we're growing and be sure that we have the microbes present that are going to use those healthy diet nutrients and components and use that as their energy source. So, for example, I grew up in Texas in the 50s in San Antonio and early 60s, let's say. And beyond eating a lot of Mexican food, which is a given, I probably had a lot of fried chicken. So my microbes from my youth were well-honed as using fried chicken for an energy source. And so now in my 60s, I'm really interested in eating a lot of things like kale and a good bit of kale. But my fried chicken-loving microbes are not about to use kale or have any part of it. And they know how to control that very, very well.
Yeah. They're
speaking
up.
It's essentially the lesson that you really are going to have an easier time in getting your body in concert or in sync or as a co-partner in changing your diet by having microbes that are going to benefit and use the higher fiber in the fresh in your diet, the fresh fruits, the fresh vegetables, and reduce processed food, and having microbes that are actually going to want those and are going to be sending signals to your brain that this is exactly what we want. This is what you need to eat. Because otherwise, they're going to be saying fried chicken.
Wow. So you're saying that if you had a steady diet of fried chicken, or if you had a steady diet of, diet sodas, or you had a diet, of Twinkies or whatever when you were young, then you are actually... you've created these microbiomes that have learned to feed off of those foods, and when you change, they literally demand to be fed and can cause cravings.
They can cause cravings, and they're a bit selfish. They want to they want their food, and you can think of them like a baby that's not going to eat it. That's not going to, I'm sure parents have seen their babies that either don't want peas or they want peas, and they have a way to tell you exactly. You'll find out whether they want peas or not, right? And it's a bit like that. They are going to use different energy sources, and that signal that they are sending to your brain is influenced by the composite around all those microbes. And so if mine were self-selected, I was basically selecting the ones that could use fried chicken, and to the detriment of the others, they were dying, fading out, and not having what they needed. And so the fried chicken ones are sitting down there, and they are it's very difficult to all of a sudden turn, if 90% of my microbes are using fried chicken, and then I've got 10% in there that might be okay with kale, that I'm going to win that battle of shifting to kale where the majority are still wanting fried chicken. It is very rough on the body, and it doesn't mean it can't happen. Some people are successful in it, but it's too low a percentage of us that are able to do it that way. It's like a brute force kind of thing. And I like to think of it as one of the examples is if you had a single tomato plant in a square plot, let's say, or we use raised bed gardening, and you had that in there, and everything else is weeds, and you've decided you're going to change the nutrient composition of the soil to benefit your single tomato plant, so eventually it can take over. That's going to take a while, and it may or may not be successful against the weeds. On the other hand, if you can change that ratio dramatically and make it more like 70 or 75% tomato plants and a minority being the weeds, and then you're going to do something that really gives the tomato plants an advantage for food, then you got a better shot. And that's exactly kind of the analogy I'm talking about, is shift the balance in the microbes so they're in sync with your healthy diet.
Now, how many species do they estimate live in our gut?
Approximately 1,000 or a little over in the gut, approximately this, that kind of number in the skin, and in the high hundreds in some of the other sites. There's still a lot of work going on in the vaginal and the urogenital tract and in the airways, but it's probably in the high hundreds in those cases. So that's bacterial species, I should say.
Yeah.
Doesn't account for the viruses and other things as well.
You know, the metaphor that I was told many years ago that just stuck with me, and you mentioned it, it's like your microbiome is like a biodiversity of a rainforest. Then you take an antibiotic or you take a steroid, or, you know, I even talk about birth control pills have similar antibiotic effects, and you clear cut the rainforest. It's like you wipe everything out, the bad guys and all the other healthy organisms, and then you have this clear-cut area that now is, vulnerable to have these invasive species move in that should not be in that community or not to the degree that they are. And that's really a great metaphor that makes sense to me about the dangers from using anything that impairs healthy microbiome growth.
Exactly right, and that's what's seen. So basically, if you treat a patient with one of the serious hospital-based infections, antibiotics for Clostridium difficile, which, by the way, dogs can detect that. They can be trained to detect the bacterial signal from that, and that's part of the book, too, is I think people enjoy reading some of the sections on dogs and even an example about chickens as well. So you treat that. And the physician's successful, it works. But you actually make the patient more susceptible to recurrence of that infection as life goes on, particularly if you do nothing else. And that's not really, you know, so risk-benefit. Yes, the life-threatening thing that's there right then, you win. But long-term, no, not so much. Because you've clear-cut, just like you said. It's going to come back, and it's going to come back even more as a result. And so I think we're going to get to a point pretty soon here with antibiotics, for example, where physicians are simply not going to be willing. If they're killing a part of you they didn't intend, they're killing part of your body they didn't intend to kill, they're going to put it back. And that's sort of a message in the book. Put back what you did not intend to kill. Hmm. And I think that's complementary therapies are going to be used for that as well. But part of the other problem is it goes way beyond antibiotics, because I'm a toxicologist and was in charge of Cornell's toxicology program for a while. And unfortunately, we develop systems, and they're called environmental health assessment, I recently co-authored a paper with a professor at Johns Hopkins about redoing that system, because we developed a strategy of determining what's safe and not safe for humans as toxicologists that did not include the microbiome and testing of safety for drugs and for environmental chemicals and food additives was always done with the target being the human mammal. So nothing has really been vetted for the microbiome in terms of human microbiome in terms of safety according to how our general strategies have been for testing. So that's essentially good news, bad news for people like me, toxicologists, is that we don't really know what's safe, but we've got a lot of work to do. We've got make work for toxicologists because we get to do it all over and put the microbiome in as the front line of exposures, whether they're inhalation exposures, dermal exposures, or oral exposures. We're hitting the microbiome first. So now we're learning that all kinds of drugs actually damage the microbiome or shift the microbiome because, of course, the microbes see it. And it was never measured for what they did. And so I can give you one example, digoxin, that's in the literature. And physicians have known they've had a fairly narrow range of effectiveness and safety for digoxin. And it would work in some patients. It doesn't work in others. And it can be toxic and can kill some patients as well. And it turns out that one species of bacterium in the gut is responsible for those three options in an individual patient: effectiveness, ineffectiveness, or toxicity. So a physician is really, to prescribe a drug like that, they're going to need to know the microbiome status, the profile, and they're going to need to know particularly about that species. Right. And that will inform physicians so that they can make drugs more effective and safer. But in the absence of that, it's a real problem. And other things like statins, like chemotherapeutic drugs, for example, they work through the microbiome. So, again, there is individual variation in patients as to whether they're effective and whether they really work. And it turns out that that's because microbiome profiles differed among humans. And we're going to want to know that. One of the more shocking findings recently is that food additives, such as there's a category called emulsifiers that make our gravies and our ice cream smooth and keep oils from separating out from foods, that some of the most common ones actually destroy the affect the bacteria that regulate our layer of mucin that's at our gut barrier. And we need that. It's sort of like a good fence makes good neighbors. And that barrier of mucin keeps some bacteria away from our enterocytes, our gut mammalian cells. And in doing so, it prevents them from instigating inflammation through our immune system. So when that barrier thins, and those bacteria are destroyed by the food emulsifiers, the regulation goes down, the barrier thins, it basically produces things like obesity and metabolic syndrome. And,
so we're emulsifying our barrier.
We're compromising some of those barriers.
Wow.
And allowing things to get in relationship to parts of our immune system and our bodies where they were just simply not intended to be, and where we can't really control the situation. So we're losing some of the status that we need there. And it's unintentional. Again, this is part of the food technology and the wonders of eating food that year-round, eating things year-round and having food available. But, again, some of these components were tested for how do they do for the human mammal, and, okay, so they looked okay, but never for the microbiome. And that's a real problem.
Well, I can't imagine pesticides and fungicides and, you know, all these chemicals could be in any way beneficial to our microbiome.
No, they're not. No, they're not. So, I mean, I've worked on toxicity, again, for the immune system in particular, and in children in early life most of my career. And so even things like bisphenol A, for example, I talk about that in the book, and Europe's approach to regulating bisphenol A versus some other countries. They can be very dangerous. And if you look around, even some of the things that we thought were kind of safe, now there is this question because they seem to damage microbes, even though it looked like they might be okay for the human mammal part of us at the levels of exposure. But I'll give you an example. So take arsenic, which is, again, a concern, particularly in drinking water. And there is individual risk for the toxicity of an exposure to arsenic in drinking water that is really regulated by what microbes you have in your gut. Because there are certain categories of it that are able to make the worst, the most toxic metabolic form of arsenic through a chemical process and what they do with arsenic. And so the levels of those you have in your gut will determine your individual risk for a toxic outcome from an arsenic exposure. And at the moment, we have no idea. The EPA and physicians have no idea whether your profile of microbiome is one that would lead you to be at you know, double the risk of another of your neighbor to arsenic by comparison, because they haven't been collecting that information. And so I think the book is really saying, you know, if we're going to approach and health professionals are going to help manage health, they're going to have microbiome information up front, and they're going to use that as their direction. And drug companies are going to make drugs that work through and with the microbiome.
And we'll probably
that's really the option. Yeah.
And then there has to be a way for us to be mapped, get to have a readout of
our
microbiome.
Yes, and you can do that. I mean, we've had, in my own family, we track our microbiome. In fact, my wife was able to see theoretically a drug that was supposed to have a pretty narrow spectrum of operation. She was prescribed that, and we were able to see how it absolutely trashed her microbiome and the length of time it took her to bring it back, basically. through a process called rebiosis, and that's in the book as well, in addition to resource section that really provides information for people. Where can they go to find information about probiotics and about options that are out there? And so there's a section toward the end of the book on that and on fermented foods, because if you think about it, that's one of the ways we now know that our ancestors stayed healthy from some of these things, is they were actually reliant in terms of their own food sources and consumption on things that were providing probiotic bacteria and prebiotics, and that would be the fermented foods. And we've kind of lost touch with that, although many people are trying to regain that.
Well, that is certainly trending and has been for a while, the importance of fermented foods, lacto-fermented foods. So that kind of takes me to the next part of our conversation before we have to bring all this to an end, which is so fascinating. We could do a whole other show and probably will. But what are your top recommendations for people to help create a healthy biome? Microbiome?
Well, I think to have a birth plan that tries to ensure that the baby is seeded, I think that is extremely important. So any age, I mean, I had, again, my own personal story in my 60s of having a pretty marked change in my health and benefit. So any age, you can do something useful in terms of changing your microbiome and shifting the dynamics of inflammation and some of these diseases. But the earlier the better, because the baby's developing systems get programmed, and there are critical events that are occurring for the neurological system and the brain and the immune system, and you really want the microbes there as co-partners for those events. So that the seeding plan, having a seeding plan, is really important. But even backing up another step, I've told people involved with helping manage the pregnancy, including OBGYNs and others that are going to, doulas and others that are going to be involved with the mom heading toward birth, that this is a golden opportunity. You've now got an opportunity to do something useful for the mom's health through the microbiome and managing that, and also preparing what will be seeded to the baby. So, for example, we're now down the road long enough with processed foods, with the environmental chemical problems, and with drugs that are having side effects that we didn't know about, that you may have a mom who has diabetes and asthma or other non-communicable diseases where with those are associated a restricted diversity of the microbiome. So they actually don't have all the species that are usually found in a healthy individual. So that's an opportunity to change the mom for the better, for her health, and again, ensure that what is seeded to that baby is not a diabetic-linked group of microbes, but is a broader diversity as well. And so you really are affecting the health of two generations through that management, and I think that's a terrific opportunity. So you go through that. You go through managing a pregnancy and the health of the mom in a completely integrated, holistic way that includes the microbiome, and then ensuring the baby has that ancestral seeding with a healthy microbiome. And then you go through, if breastfeeding is a possibility, the benefits of that. And the fact that you want to work with physicians who we now think, and the medical community agrees, that they're over-prescribing antibiotics, although individual physicians don't always say, it's me doing it. They'll often say someone else that's involved with that problem. But there is over-prescription of antibiotics, particularly for things like ear infections, that a certain percentage of those are thought to be viral and would resolve. And that's a problem because between birth and 1 year of age, there's a direct relationship between whether antibiotics are given to the baby and the number of rounds the baby has and the risk of asthma at age five, for example, five or seven. Mm-hmm. And so managing the health, the pediatricians, managing the health in a way that doesn't deprive the baby of needed medications, and that's not what it's saying, but is really looking at maybe antibiotics plus probiotics and different ways to ensure that the baby's microbiome is not depleted. And I do talk in the book about how microbiome profiles are being done now and options to where that's going to likely become standard. Just like we moved ultrasound into doctor's offices where it didn't used to be, I think we're going to, if we're going to be collecting blood profiles of patients and have that on record, we're going to have microbiome profiles as well.
So should everyone be taking a good probiotic, do you think?
Well, I wouldn't say blanket that that's the case. I think a lot of people can benefit from it, but unfortunately at the moment, what a good probiotic is still a bit of a question mark. Mm-hmm. And so in our own case, what we did was to go to the literature and find the ones that had the most research behind them, and as a second step, go to something essentially analogous to a TripAdvisor selection of a hotel room. And I hate to put it that way, but it's really to say, well, the literature, the scientific literature in terms of peer-reviewed literature says that this is a really good source of probiotics, this formulation. And I encourage people to look at the strain of the bacteria, mm-hmm. not just the species, because it's the strain that is telling you the mix of genes that the species carries. So one formulation of Lactobacillus acidophilus is not necessarily the same as another, not necessarily carrying the same genes. And the genes in the end are what will affect your metabolism and the signaling for your physiological systems. So we did, you know, you do that, you find good candidates. Often they're mixtures of more than one. And I do talk about resources where people can go to not-for-profit organizations, sites that are really the experts now in probiotics and prebiotics. And they will provide guidelines as well, without recommending individual companies or, you know, in that way, but just to provide some good guidance on it, instruction. So we did that. We found the ones with the best literature. We then went to the issue of, has anybody actually benefited at taking this? You know, real people, my neighbors in communities, and used a TripAdvisor kind of approach. And then the final test, the third step was, does it work in my body? Can I actually notice any difference if I'm persistent enough in trying it? And those were the three steps we used personally to vet it. And I think that, unfortunately, it's that kind of type of strategy probably, because there's no single gold standard for if everyone only took this, it would be great. And in fact, everyone doesn't necessarily need the same solution. You need something that's going to get you to a healthier profile in your microbiome. And it may be a healthier profile based on what your ancestors used to eat for thousands of years. So we're finding now that there's no single healthy microbiome right. profile. There are probably six or seven based on geography, where people lived for thousands of years, the food they ate, the plants, what their environment looked like around them. And so there are probably six or seven ideal microbiome profiles. And moving to one that's most compatible with where your ancestors were and what they were doing is probably easier on your body than trying to move half a world away.
So check out a really high-quality probiotic supplement, especially if you've had some antibiotics or steroids. Fiber, right? That's
fiber, absolutely, absolutely. You need the food of the microbes, and that's going to be fiber-rich, and it's going to the fresh fruits and vegetables, and you're going to want to be very careful, again, about environmental chemicals and pesticides, and because
so
those are, yeah, absolutely, those can be devastating for the
organic.
Microbiome.
So organic, again, that's where the role of vegetables, fruits come in, because they provide the fiber, and there are also fiber supplements that people can be taking.
Absolutely.
Fiber, right? That's the food.
Well, and see, you can get probiotics that have the prebiotics in them, things like inulin and other things that are called, mm-hmm. that are considered prebiotic components. And so you're really taking the microbes and their food and some of these formulations, and that's really, really helpful. But just to realize, once you know, if you're trying to install them, and it doesn't have to be your gut, by the way, there will likely be products where you'll, after you use a cosmetic or you use sunscreen or something that affects the microbiome in your skin, you very likely will follow that up by repopulating and putting mm-hmm. some back, because the people that map the microbiome in the skin, they can tell what commercial products, what you've been using and putting on your skin because of the changes in the microbiome.
Well, this has been such a fascinating conversation. I really encourage everyone to pick up a copy of The Human Superorganism, How the Microbiome is Revolutionizing the Pursuit of a Healthy Life. I think it's profound information. And Dr. Rodney Dietert, I just so appreciate your research, and you're so articulate in how you've communicated all this. And I'm just very grateful for the message you're getting out there into the world so we can have a healthy future, you know, and healthy babies as well. It's so important.
Well, thank you for the chance to be on the show.
It's been a pleasure. And for all of you listening, thank you again for joining me for another opportunity to have this wonderful in-depth conversation so you can really step into a level of greater knowledge and empowerment in your life. And remember, as always, take care and honor your feminine self. So until next time, have a great week. We'll be talking to you soon. Bye for now.